From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, eight candidates for chair of the Democratic National Committee went head-to-head in a CNN debate. Taking the fight to President Trump and reaching out to working-class voters were center stage. On Saturday, Democrats will vote for their new chair, making one of their first big decisions since losing the election in November. Where does the party go from here? This hour, On Point, the DNC chair and the future of the Democratic Party. Joining me first today from Atlanta, Georgia, is Gabriel DeBenedetti, political reporter for Politico. He's been covering the DNC race in depth. Gabriel, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
Well, we're down to the final couple of hours till the balloting begins. What are the candidates up to now?
Yeah, that's right. The vote is actually going to happen on Saturday morning here in Atlanta. And of what they're doing right now is basically trying to win over the few undecided DNC voters. There are only 440, roughly, folks that actually get to vote in this thing. They're all descending on Atlanta now over the last few days and in the next coming hours. So the members are trying to win them over, and in some cases trying to not necessarily be their first choice, but their second choice, because a lot of folks are assuming that this thing, which has been a long and contentious fight already, is going to go to multiple rounds of balloting, which the party hasn't really seen in 20 or 30 years.
Who are these 400-plus people who are going to decide, at least in the near term, the future course of the DNC?
Yeah, well, some people think they're the establishment. You know, these are a lot of local party activists. They are state party leaders. In some cases, they are elected officials, either on the local or national level. But in many cases, these are just folks who are really engaged in the process of running the party and the party committees on a local level. So, you know, state party chairs, state party officials, organizers. And again, there are only 440 of them, roughly. So they've been getting a lot of personal attention from the chairs.
Since the much-publicized departure of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Congresswoman from Florida, who's been minding the store?
Well, Donna Brazile, who is a longtime Democratic operative, you know, ran Al Gore's campaign, worked for Bill Clinton, and has been the interim chair before, has been serving in an interim capacity. She was a vice chair before this, and she's been doing it ever since Debbie Wasserman Schultz was sort of ousted in July at the time of the convention, the presidential convention. And she's been basically just trying to mind the store, as you say. She was keeping up the budgeting and the operations during the campaign and has now been trying to manage the handover to whoever the new chair is going to be. So her interim term will end on Saturday.
Just the other day, one of the leading contenders for DNC chair, former Secretary of Labor Tom Perez, sent out a social media message saying basically, I'm pretty close. What kind of reaction did he get from the other candidates?
Well, the other candidates were not thrilled. I mean, the thing to know about this is that the race appears to be a two-person race in terms of who the frontrunners are. It's between Tom Perez, as you say, the former Labor Secretary, and Keith Ellison, who is a congressman from Minnesota. Ellison's folks really reacted poorly to the idea that Perez was about to be there. Perez's note said that he had 180 backers of the needed 220 or so, and the Ellison folks sent out a letter signed by Keith Ellison himself basically saying, Perez is trying to put his finger on the scale. We don't think he has that number. We're confident we're going to win. So it's gotten a little bit chippy in the final days. It's been a race marked by not much actual disagreement, but a lot of assumed disagreement because of Ellison's siding, in theory at least, with the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, and Perez's with the Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama wing, but they don't really clash all that much.
Many of the candidates have been playing the endorsement game, and I guess it's important to have big names on your side. In a video endorsement published Tuesday, civil rights icon and Georgia Democratic Congressman John Lewis called DNC chair candidate and Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison an organizer who will make sure no part of the country is left behind.
You want to make the DNC relevant to the problems and to the needs of all of our people. He would help our party catch up and make it possible for us to get more people registered and turn out more people to vote on Election Day.
Congressman John Lewis is close to a secular saint as any political party ever has, during a December 16th news conference, then-President Obama said he doesn't have a vote for DNC chair, and the other declared candidates are fine people. But he praised his then-Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez.
He is tireless. He is wicked smart. He has been able to work across the spectrum of, you know, labor, business, activists. He's produced.
How important, Gabe DeBenedetti, is this part of the jockeying?
Well, it's an interesting question because, as we've said, there are only so many people who vote on this thing, and a lot of them have very interesting views about these national figures who are offering endorsements. So a lot of them are actually mistrustful of the work that, in some ways, Obama has done to help build the party because, as many people have noted, the party actually suffered in terms of local seats under his presidency. So while a lot of party members obviously love the former president, they don't necessarily think that he is the one to be offering advice on how to run the committee. That said, there has been an endorsements fight. Some of the most influential endorsements, however, are former DNC chairs. A lot of them have been going to people like South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who's a lesser-known candidate, but who sort of is offering himself up as the candidate of the future here. There are other people running, such as South Carolina Chairman Jamie Harrison, who also has a lot of endorsements from folks who are in the process of actually running these parties. So while it is important for Perez that he, for example, has the explicit endorsement of Joe Biden, and for Ellison to have the explicit endorsement of people including Bernie Sanders, Chuck Schumer, Elizabeth Warren, that is not necessarily what's actually swaying over the actual voters. It's made it clear to, you know, rank-and-file Democrats where these people stand, but the actual voters in this thing are much more swayed by the conversations they're having one-on-one with the candidates.
When you look across the sweep, and it is a lot of people who want this job, are there really that many differences between them, the wings of the party they might hail from, the approach to the future they might have, their suggestions for how to build a more successful electoral future?
On the face of it, no, there are certainly not that many disagreements. They all agree that the party is not necessarily in the best shape right now and that one of the best ways to come back is to, invest heavily in state parties, to have a serious investment in local elections and building a candidate pipeline, to be neutral during the primary, presidential primary nominating processes. In these ways, they're not really disagreeing all that much, and that's why the race has not been particularly contentious. But if you look at this from a national perspective and from the perspective of where these people are coming from, a lot of folks have decided to make this a referendum on the future of the party, assuming that the DNC chair, which is really just an operative's position that is focused on raising money, messaging, the operations of the party and its budget, they're trying to make this into a spokesman or a face of the party type role. And that's why we're starting to see a lot of tension between folks who, you know, supported Bernie Sanders during the primary and felt that the process was, as a lot of them call it, rigged. And many of those people are with Ellison. And there are other folks who are with Perez. And Perez, of course, has said that he identifies with a lot of the Sanders voters. And Ellison has said he identifies with a lot of the Clinton voters. So they're trying to shy away from it. But in terms of actual substantive differences in what they're proposing, there's not a ton.
The 50-state strategy, pioneered by Howard Dean and sold very heavily by Howard Dean, is perceived to have worked. Is that now baked into the cake? Is there anybody saying, no 50-state strategy?
For a number of reasons, they're not saying that. Howard Dean is sort of seen as the person that every single one of these candidates refers to over and over as someone who we should be following, who they should be following, the example of at least. But we have to keep in mind that part of this can be read at least as a pander. The people that vote for this position are in a lot of cases state Democratic officials. So of course they're going to want to hear that there's going to be more investment in their state party, even if they're not a big swing state. In that respect, it's not surprising at all to see all the candidates say, we need to return to a 50-state strategy that sees the Montana Democratic Party get just as much money as the Wisconsin Democratic Party. Now, it may not actually be the exact same amount of money being distributed to these places, but the idea that some of these state parties that in some ways really have fallen apart or been hollowed out in the last 8-10 years, the idea that they would get more attention is really attractive to the kinds of people that vote for this thing.
Well, Howard Dean was on MSNBC yesterday, and he's endorsed the South Bend, Indiana mayor, Pete Buttigieg, for chair of the DNC. And he's also won, Mayor Pete has, the endorsement of Martin O'Malley. So three former DNC chairs and nine mayors.
I just think this guy's the real deal. And I think this is the only way that we're going to capture this generation and get them to align with the Democratic Party. This is our future. This is not just about a 50-state strategy. It's about a 50-year strategy. And we can't do it unless we're willing to pivot to outside the Beltway.
These people, the other people who are running, what happens after the first ballot if nobody gets the required 220 plus to just be home and dry after one ballot? Do they have to drop out? Do the lowest vote getters have to drop out, or is it sort of a staring contest at that point?
Yeah, so this is a little bit complicated, and there's a bit of confusion going around Atlanta, actually, about this specific question. But my understanding, after talking to DNC officials, is that after two rounds of voting, the bottom vote-getters will be eliminated round by round. So, as you said, there are eight people running for this thing, and at least two or three of them are unlikely to get any votes at all because of their profiles. So they're likely to be lopped off after two rounds if we get there. But you only go multiple rounds in the first place if no one reaches a majority of the votes.
That's Gabriel DeBenedetti, political reporter for Politico. Gabe, thanks for joining us. We're talking about the future leadership of the DNC. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the future of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. You can join the conversation. Does the DNC need to become more progressive? Joining me now in Hartford, Connecticut, is Bill Curry, two-time Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut and former White House counselor to Bill Clinton. He's now a columnist for Salon.com. Bill Curry, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you, Ray.
And in Washington, Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and principal at the Rabin Group, a Democratic political consulting firm. He was a DNC communications advisor to the Obama-Biden presidential campaign in 2008. Jamal Simmons, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Good to talk to you.
Gentlemen, I want to start in the same place with both of you. Why does it matter who the chairman of the DNC is? Jamal?
Well, I would say that it matters because the most important part of this job, it's maybe 80%, 75 or 80%, is how Democrats raise money and spend that money up and down the ballot to get other Democrats elected. And so you need to have somebody who's focused on that. The other 20 or 25% is the public-facing part of the job. And that's the place where we need someone in the party architecture who understands what's happening out in the streets where the real fight against Donald Trump is occurring, and they can channel that energy into electoral prospects.
Bill Curry, same question.
Well, I would say, first of all, it might matter a little less than it seems. And I would just say that you want to just stop and ask, what is the Democratic Party? What is a political party? Then what is the DNC? The DNC in my lifetime is really simply a closed pack that spends most of its time in service to its donors and recruiting a kind of Washington-based professional talent, pollsters, message consultants, et cetera. A political party builds constituencies behind ideas. It organizes and encourages at every turn public participation. And on that first point, it understands, and you can – I've had the occasion to work across the world and meet political party leaders, not just elected officials in countries ranging from Central America to Asia to Europe. And I was always struck from the very beginning at how much more they – all those party leaders knew and talked about policy. And you can't build a political party without understanding its, you know, its core principles, not just its core themes, not just its message. Policy precedes message. You want politicians with the courage of their convictions? First, get some convictions. I watched that whole debate last night, and there was virtually no discussion of where this party has gone wrong on policy, nor was there in almost 2 hours any discussion of specific reform of the institution itself. And so the Democratic Party is more than the DNC. It's the presidency. It's the Congress. It's most of all the grassroots and other institutional forces, labor, women's groups, people who work on environmental and peace issues. The rift between that small corporate fundraising pack at the top and that vast base has in my lifetime never been greater.
Let me go back to Jamal.
I don't hear much about how to fix that.
That split between the idea guy and the sort of mechanic. Do you agree with what Bill Curry just said?
Do I agree? I guess the short answer is yes, but. The difference between what's happening in the United States and what happens other places is, especially in parliamentary systems, our elected officials are not the people who make up the party. So, for instance, the leader of the Democratic Party isn't expected to be the next candidate for president like it might be in the Labor Party in, you know, Great Britain. So we could have a political science discussion about, like, why that's the case. But I think what's happening here, which is different, is our policy leaders are the people we elect who are in Congress, who are governors, who are mayors, who are state legislators. Those are the people who we look to solve our policy problems. The Democratic Party apparatus is meant to support them with the infrastructure, financing, and the build out a whole system that will help propel those people into elected office. And that's why the last part I'll say about this is it's also important that we have a Democratic Party chair who understands the new face of the Democratic Party, where 46% or so of the people who vote for Democrats are people of color. And we have not seen the kind of diversity in the top of the Democratic organizations we need to and the consultants that will actually help get Democrats elected.
Jamal Simmons and Bill Curry are with me. The Democratic National Committee will elect its new chair on Saturday morning. We'll start in Braintree, Massachusetts. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Okay.
Good. I probably need therapy because I took 2 hours last night and watched the entire debate on CNN. And while I question the quality of the questions that the CNN asked, I think there was, for me, and as an outsider, as an independent, registered independent in the state of Massachusetts, it seemed that the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who comes from a red state, Pete Buttigieg, if mm-hmm. I'm pronouncing that name correctly, was inspirational. He is a millennial. He is a clear break from everything that seemed to have been wrong with the Democratic Party in the last election. I think he will, again, what I think the Democratic chair needs to do is attract new people and reinforce the people who are already either enrolled or have an intention to vote on a Democratic ticket. And I think he just was clear. He spoke in complete sentences, much like President Obama, in paragraphs, I thought. And I just thought, this man's intelligence is coming through. And he didn't seem to have an axe to grind. I mean, he comes from the state where Mike Pence was governor and is now vice president. So I think the fact that he comes from a red state, he's been able to be reelected, I believe, 2 times as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and apparently has been very progressive in his position there. To me, you know, if it were up to me, and I'm visit, I would seriously consider Pete, I guess they call him Mayor Pete, for the DNC chair. That's my observation as an independent.
Paul, thanks for your call. Bill Curry?
Yeah, I wasn't as impressed, although I was impressed in the same way as the caller was impressed. I thought that he spoke in paragraphs. I thought that he spoke very clearly. I think that the stuff is a little bit off point, and that is to say the debate last night. And I would just point out one, looking at the Democratic Party in the 3 months since the Trumpocalypse, they had the chance to regenerate leadership in the House and the Senate. They have as old a legislative leadership contingent in both houses of Congress as they have ever had. When seniority was even at its peak, they weren't this old. The Republicans have turned over leadership in its entirety 3 times while this same group of Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, et cetera, have held office. And I looked at this race and I listened last night, again, for both policy and for specific reforms. No one even asked them if they were going to get rid of all the superdelegates. No one asked them if they were going to undo the Debbie Wasserman Schultz changes that opened up more big donor fundraising. I could go on. No one – very few people know how the Democratic National Committee is elected. And it's elected from state central committees, which are often the only political offices in their states for which no one can primary. It's a closed system. That's part of why it's drifted away. One of the reasons the congressional leaders have been more for Keith Ellison is that they must, by the nature of their offices, be more in touch with that grassroots change that's going on in their party. And I didn't hear from the mayor or from many people a sense of how big a change we really need right now. When Obama was doing so many of his farewell interviews, he would always be asked, what was the biggest mistake you made? And his answer was invariably that he didn't do a good enough job of telling his story. But actually, I think the Democratic Party has fine storytellers. It's the story itself. It's the question of policy. You can't build an organization. A political organization runs on policy.
Let me stop you right there, Bill Curry, because I think story is one of those terms that gets used a lot. But it's a story about something. And when we're in 2017 and now people are first learning that the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare are the same thing, they're first learning what the boundaries and possibilities of this law is in year five. Maybe he didn't tell his story about a policy well enough. Yeah, you can dismiss the term story, but it's story about what? About the signature domestic achievement of his 8 years as president.
Everything Obama did will look good while Trump's president, including Obamacare, looking better to more people by a slight 2 or 3 point difference from what it has been. But if the president had made the decision to enact a public option, which he himself personally and privately opposed throughout the process in the House and Senate when he was in that first year of his presidency until it was passed. The House passed a public option over his opposition. The Senate got 53 votes publicly for it. The public option was the only thing people could score that showed savings for the government, and it was the only thing that could bring down costs for small businesses and the self-employed, who were the people who got gouged in this last 6 years, as they always had been. If we'd raised the minimum wage when we had the votes in both houses, which we chose not to do because we decided it would offend too many Wall Street donors. If we'd bailed out the homeowners, the 18 million homeowners whose mortgages were underwater when we came in. If we'd kept our promises on ethics, every one of which could have been implemented by executive order in the normal course of business, instead of breaking all of them, the president would have been a folk hero rather than a punching bag.
The president is a folk hero for most Democrats, and I think for most people
is.
In the country,
and,
you're seeing.
And that's going to be one of the hard things about making change now, because we can't recognize the mistakes.
Let's give Jamal a chance to get his
own. I'm not going to sit here and argue that everything Barack Obama did was perfect, but I will say that we all live in our political time. And so, like you, I also served in the Clinton administration, and I think there were things that Bill Clinton was very good at reestablishing Democrats as a party you can trust with the budget, a party you can trust with national security, after 30 years of people believing that Democrats weren't really that good at that. So Barack Obama was able to build on another generation and take us even further, and was able to do something that no one had been able to do before, which was get a national health care plan that would ensure more Americans. And now I think the president is right that he did a very good job telling his story in his campaigns. He did not do a very good job telling the story of how his policies are going to impact the real problems that people are facing. And so what you saw in 2008 and 2009 were people who were really upset, who felt really left out, who reached out and they wanted a moment of hope to take us in a direction. And I think some of those people didn't feel like they were as tended to. So by 2016, they worked out in a moment of anger. And a lot of those people picked Donald Trump because they still wanted somebody who was going to shake the system up. And that's where Bill's right. The Democrats have to get on the board with shaking the system up.
Quickly, Bill.
Jamal, I just want to say that it's the very love that Democrats feel for President Obama that's going to make it hard to recognize the mistakes we made. And the important thing here, all change begins with taking responsibility. And the issues I ticked off were all issues about economic empowerment or political reform. And that's what we lost on in this election. That's how we lost 900 legislative seats. That's how we lost the House, the Senate, the vast majority of governorships. And that's how we ended up losing to the least qualified, most temperamentally unfit candidate for president of the United States, I think, in American history. And so we begin this discussion now by taking a hard look. It'll be very hard emotionally for us, I think, in part, for some of the reasons you just cited, to step back and say, is any of this our responsibility? And I think that we're too concerned with how we tell our story and not concerned enough with the fundamental policies that we've embraced.
I got to get in there. Hold on, fellas. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point. Bill Curry and Jamal Simmons are with me. Our number is 800-423-8255. And Ashley's calling from Auburn, Alabama. Ashley, welcome.
Yes. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling to kind of actually bring attention to actually a candidate that no one has actually mentioned yet, but it actually is a candidate, and he actually kind of rivals Ellison with his progressivism, which this party absolutely needs after this past election, and it's Sam Ronan. He's only 27. I believe he is an immigrant from Germany. And the reason I want to bring up Sam Ronan is because he has the biggest thing about him is he wants to get big money out of the elections. He wants to stop taking money from lobbyists. Otherwise we remain beholden to these big money interests, which by and large does not support democracy or a democratic process in any way. He's kind of the Bernie Sanders of this small race. He has said multiple times that he wants to bring the party back to the people, and that we've ignored the working class. And I think he's right. And I mean, I think that's the big thing. There are a lot of people that voted for Obama in the working class that did not vote for Obama this time around. And admittedly, I'm one of them. I voted for Jill Stein. I just I didn't think Hillary stood for my interests. And in no way will I ever voted for Donald Trump. But
well, you know, Ashley, that by voting for Jill Stein, you threw Alabama to the Republicans. I think I have to check my math, but. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But let me ask you more about Sam Ronan. Do you think the candidates outside of Tom Perez and Keith Ellison have gotten enough attention?
Outside of Perez and Ellison?
Yeah, no,
not really. Honestly, they've kind of been the stars of the show, so to speak. The front runners, if you will. Even then, I don't think Ellison has even gotten enough attention, even though he is kind of a front runner. I think Perez has kind of been the favorite, so to speak, at least of the establishment. But no, I don't think so. And I've been watching the debates. I actually, unfortunately, missed one last night. But honestly, I don't think they've all started kind of adopting this working class. We need to pay attention to the working class narrative a little more than they were before, because I think they know they have to, because in my opinion, it lost them the election this time. But it's still, it seems kind of superficial. In my opinion, so I don't think they've gotten enough attention. And honestly, if we want to be true to a democratic process, they all should have equal attention.
Let me throw that to the guest, Ashley, calling from Auburn, Alabama. Jamal, we've heard a lot about who to appeal to now, who to talk to now, who to try to get back on the democratic train now, and you're hearing different prescriptions. Some people are saying, move left. You're not going to get those people in southern Ohio and western Pennsylvania who've switched and voted for Donald Trump after voting for Barack Obama. That Democratic Party is over. Time to build the next one. You heard Ashley talking about an appeal to working class voters, and specifically, I mean, if you're talking to Latinos and blacks, you're talking to working class voters in the main. So what direction are we talking about for a party that really had some problems last time?
Here's what I reject. I reject the notion that this is either about working class whites or it's about people of color. As you just said, working class people across the country need a message from Democrats, and that's what we need to focus on. But we also need to recognize that we're not going to win every Reagan Democrat that we used to win. We have to focus on the voters who actually will vote for us. And Steve Phillips' article in the New York Times yesterday laid this out very well.
Well, hold that thought. Let's talk more about the coming DNC. I'm Ray Suarez in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This hour, we're talking about the upcoming vote by Democrats for the chair of the Democratic National Committee. You can join the conversation. Can the shakeup of the DNC come from the establishment, or does it need to be an outsider? With me today in Hartford, Connecticut, is Bill Curry, two-time Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut and former White House counselor to Bill Clinton. In Washington, Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and principal at the Rabin Group, a Democratic political consulting firm. He was a DNC communications advisor to the Obama presidential campaign in 2008. Joining us now, also from Washington, Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. She herself considered running as chair for the DNC. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ray. It's great to be here.
What do you make of the race so far? Has the public face of this campaign, which is, after all, a campaign that, in its narrowest sense, is aimed at 440-some-odd people, been a friend to the Democratic Party?
I think it has. I mean, I think one of the things we've seen both through the election and post-election, including in this race, is a much more widespread participation in the mechanics and the infrastructure of the Democratic Party that ultimately grows power. People need to be invested in who the DNC chair is, regardless of who they're backing. And people also need to know that even though only 447 people vote, they can lobby their state party chairs. They can lobby their committee members. And that's how we create engagement at the local level. That's how we create accountability at the local level. And that's how we grow as a party.
Has the calendar been the DNC's friend? It seems to me like this has been going on forever.
Well, I mean, look, this is the standard process. We can certainly look back and say, should we have altered the standard process given that we're living in a time that is unprecedented? And perhaps my opinion is yes, but it is what it is. And, you know, part of the process is our strength as a party, which is that we maximize participation. I think that the ideas that are being debated on that stage and on many stages prior to last night are ones that the party absolutely has to grapple with. And this is the thing. I mean, I thought there were a couple points last night that were really instructive to me. They're not sexy points. They're not points that are going to win people a lot of accolades. But when Jamie Harrison stands up there and says, people need to understand the rules, right? And Sally Ann Boynton Brown stood up there and said, people need to understand the role of the DNC party chair, the fundamental function of the DNC and the person who leads it is long-term party building. It is infrastructure building. It's not flash in the pan. It's not who has the best one-liner against Trump, but it is who has the ideas that are going to look to 2018, 2020, 2024, because that's how long it's going to take us to rebuild. And it's not sexy, but it is important.
Elise Hoag and Jamal Simmons are in Washington. Bill Curry's in Hartford. We've been getting your input from online sources. Maureen writes, start winning by listening to the left. We need economic policies for everyone, period. Lightbody writes, the next DNC chair needs to stop rigging things like in 1944 and 2016. Let the people's voice be heard. Thinkin15 says, I can't help remembering how successful the Democratic convention was last year. It was uplifting, positive, and Hillary Clinton's ratings got a big boost that lasted for about 6 weeks. Then the Trump campaign, WikiLeaks, and Comey stepped up their propaganda and character assassination campaign. Then the Democratic message became all about defense and batting down the fake news. What the Dems need is a brilliant message manager and strategist who can battle the right-wing propaganda on a daily, hourly basis. We'll go next to Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom is on the line. Tom, welcome.
The new chairman of the DNC has to be a salesman. Get out there and sell, sell, sell the things that made the Democratic Party what the Democratic Party is. And basically, they have to pick up the telephone at the county level. They have to field candidates. They have all these uncontested seats that are going, and they have to get the signage out, get your signs going. Now, if the
Tom, you say that as if there is a line or a couple of lines that you can sum up the Democratic Party. When you start talking about what the Democratic Party is, what is it?
if the little guy makes money, the big guy will make money. That's been proven economically, and that's really what the message is. They forgot their message. They're off message. But I wanted to discuss, for the sake of discussion, the underlying issue here. In the last election, the young millennium women, they voted hands down for the pro-life candidate. And whether he's pro-life or not, that's another story. But for the sake of discussion, is there anything that the Democrats, they lose on the abortion issue? Is there any kind of wiggle room or compromise room there where we're not called the party of the baby killers? Maybe abortion should go through a judicial tribune or something or other, where every little child, a baby, has due process. And maybe if it's voted that the child has to come to term, then we'll put all the support and money behind it to bring that child to term.
Bill Curry, what do you think of what Tom's saying in Wisconsin, a state that used to be a fairly reliable one in the national elections for Democrats?
He made two points, and I agree with one and not the other. I'll just take the second one very quickly. All polling data I've ever seen in virtually every discussion I've ever had says to me that millennial women are overwhelmingly pro-choice, more so than women of all age groups combined, et cetera. So they just and I'm pretty sure that's just not true. As what he said about the leader of the party, is a point that I actually agree with. And the most important thing actually in the short term that the head of the DNC chair will do is be a strategist, a visionary, a spokesperson. This is what all – very few CEOs of large organizations are administrators, almost none anymore. They almost all fit that. And the Democratic Party, particularly right now, its congressional leaders aren't good spokespeople. They're just not, and they haven't figured out what they're doing wrong yet, and they are very resistant to change. And so having a DNC chair come in right now, that person's going to be so much in demand on television and every possible media, and having that person be someone who can convey a clear picture of how we're going to fix the problems that people really care about would be the greatest thing we could do. Building a political party is like wiring a house for electricity. You can do all the wiring and the appliances perfectly, but if there's no juice in the system, when you throw the switch, the lights don't go on. And what the Democratic Party misses right now is that core message, which I think was embodied, by the way, in the Sanders campaign. He made three points. One is that the democracy is corrupt. Two is that the middle class is dying. And three, that the reason the middle class is dying is that the democracy is corrupt. This is a sentiment shared almost universally across democracies across the globe. We've been in a global insurrection against economic oligarchy and political corruption. And if the Democratic Party wants to become the progressive party in America, it's going to have to embody those principles and show people not just that it's saying it, but that this time we really mean it.
Elise Hoge, since we have you here, let's talk briefly about abortion politics and whether that's been an Achilles heel. At least regionally, I'm not going to take Tom's point at face value that it's a problem for Democrats everywhere. But is it a problem for Democrats some places?
No, I don't think it is, and I think all the data doesn't show that it is. In fact, a plurality of rank and file Republicans report being in support of Roe versus Wade. I think this is the ultimate straw man. I think that most people in this country firmly believe that those issues are best left to a woman and her family. And I think, guess what, that the Republicans know it, because you had a candidate who was 100% in favor of reproductive rights, and none of the Republican Party committees ever ran a single ad against her on it, because they know it's a loser of an issue. The one thing that I do think we need to pay attention to that was inherent in that question but not addressed directly is that the DNC is never going to function if we're only thinking about it as a vehicle to get a president elected, right? This is a vertically integrated system, to Bill's sort of house wiring analogy, and the DNC chair has to be all about enabling the state and local parties to bring in particularly the outpouring of energy that we're feeling right now. And the good news is it's actually happening. I mean, local party officials and state party chairs are actually reporting a huge influx of energy. And I think that the basic value proposition that we hold as Democrats is actually being heard right now. The question is, do we have someone in the race who's committed to building the infrastructure to leverage that energy for the long term, from the school boards to the city councils to the state legislatures, and then the presidency comes.
Forsyth, Georgia is next. Galen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind, Galen?
I am a local county party chair. I was not involved in politics until 6 months ago, wherever I found out that my county did not have a party, and I formed a committee to restart it. My point is, I think the DNC and the state parties need to focus on their local parties. We are the boots on the ground, and I think we can be the most focused asset of helping redefine what it means to be a Democrat. I myself am a truck driver, and I work 70 hours a week. I am what this party's fighting for, is your common middleman, and I think the local parties is your always going to be your best bet. We're personally, in the counties around us, are very high energy. We've got young Democrats coming in. We've got the Boys and Girls Club coming into our county. But I wish that we could see more tools and training and assets being funneled to the local party.
Galen, calling from Forsyth, Georgia. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point. Jamal, I think Galen's point brings us right to the crux of the matter. Do you put money into sure things to sort of build your cornerstone, or do you start putting money in places like Forsyth, where, in fact, it's not promising in the short term for Democrats? Can you spend money now that pays off 10 years from now?
You have to. And that was the lesson of the Howard Dean era in the Democratic Party. And I remember that era because I was out doing a lot of campaigns at that time. And we went from a situation where, you know, we lost the House, we lost the Senate, we lost the White House, to one where we controlled, after Howard Dean, by 2008, after Howard Dean had been in office, focused on his 50-state project, we had won, Democrats had won the majorities of state legislatures, the majority of the governor's mansions, congressional majorities, and we had won the White House. And what happened is, I love Barack Obama. I think he's a fantastic human being and a leader, but he was not a great party leader. And what happened is, after that, we lost the majorities of all those things because we kind of pulled the rug out from under that 50-state project, 50-state program, and we ended up suffering. And what I want to make sure of is that we do have a Democratic Party chair who is focused on a big national message, but let's not let the national Democratic message get in the way of somebody who's in Forsyth, Georgia, or in Alabama, or in West Virginia. Let them run their own races, and we can run races in Connecticut and in California the way we ought to. They ought to be able to do the same thing in Indiana and Alabama.
We'll stop next in Columbia, South Carolina. Getting a lot of calls from Red America today. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call.
John, before you say your piece, let me ask you something. Are you a Democrat?
Well, up until this presidential election, I would have said yes.
Well, yeah, I heard that hesitation there.
I'm affiliated with the Greens now.
Okay. Let's say you were taking a look at rejoining, since you said that up until recently you would have answered yes. Do you think that the Democratic Party can start looking far down the road, can afford to look far down the road and accept a shellacking next year where there's a very unpromising map in 2018?
I think they have to take a long-term view if they're to have a future. I'm one of many Bernie Sanders supporters who wound up voting third party in the presidential election. The data seems to suggest that there are a lot of us. And the narrative has become, rightly or wrongly, that Keith Ellison is the sort of Bernie wings candidate. And I think a lot of us are watching this election for signs that the party has learned its lesson and is ready to embrace younger, more progressive voters. And I think without doing that, even if in the short term it does cost some seats, even if it's a bit bruising electorally, I think that without doing that, it's going to be very hard to have a identity and a coalition going forward.
Bill Curry, you just heard what our caller said in South Carolina. Is this a party stamped by Bernie Sanders much more than Hillary Clinton in 2017?
By a wide margin everywhere except in the DNC and in the party structure itself.
It's true in the DNC also.
Yeah,
there are a lot of people who are Bernie Sanders supporters in the DNC, and that's where the energy of the party is on the left.
There are a lot, but if there were a broad vote rather than the 448 unelected members of the Democratic National Committee by any public process, it would be an overwhelming generational change. Whereas right now, Tom Perez probably is a little bit ahead, and so you know, sure, there's opinions everywhere. But I would just say the party has to come to terms with a couple of things, and you know, one of which is the marriage it's made with big money. People who think you can raise money on Wall Street all day and fight for the working middle class at night are like people who think you can smoke crack and still be a good parent. There's a fundamental corruption here. We have to decide whether we really believe that the power of ideas is greater than the power of money, and then we have to act like we believe it. The second thing I just want to point out, I know we're at the end here, is there's enormous vitality going on among the progressive base, which is doing everything that's getting done right now. And you look at the Working Families Party and 350.org and Democracy for America and Move On, these true, authentically, democratically accountable grassroots movements have never been bigger. This is the greatest progressive resurgence right now of my lifetime. At the same time, the Democratic National Committee is on a respirator. They'd better figure out why that fjord exists between themselves and their own base.
That's Bill Curry, two-time Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut and former White House counselor to Bill Clinton. Thanks for joining us. Bill was along with Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and principal at the Rabin Group. Jamal, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
We were also joined by Elise Hogue, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Thanks for being with us, Elise.
Thank you.
I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Mashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.